Brethren, we hear a good deal in the Bible about buying fields. The first notable instance is that in Genesis chapter 23 of Abraham's buying the field at Hebron for 400 shekels of silver for the cave of Machpelah, where Sarah was buried. The purchase was all the more remarkable since God had given all the land to Abraham as for an everlasting possession, and Abraham looked for the resurrection of the dead. The field was a cave in a holy place and is there to this day. Otherwise, he owned no living estate property. That awaits the resurrection of the dead. Further to the north, near Shechem, Jacob bought a parcel of a field for 100 silver ingots, where he spread his tent in Genesis 33, 19 and 20. He named the place El Eloha Israel. This is the celebrated site of Jacob's well, where in later times the woman from Samaria talked with Jesus. Under the law of Moses, before Israel entered into possession of the land, God prescribed the terms for both temporal and eternal inheritance. In Leviticus 25, the law of the Sabbath of rest under the land is given, and then follows the law of the Jubilee. The land should not be sold forever, for the land is mine. For ye are strangers and sojourners with me. Leviticus 25:23. These things were a real foreshadowing of good things to come. Yet in Leviticus 26, after the curses for disobedience, it is said that the land should enjoy her Sabbaths while Israel should be in captivity. Another striking purchase of a field is found in the book of Ruth, and where Boaz redeemed a field of which was our brother Elimelech's in Ruth chapter 4, verse 3. A nearer kinsman declining the redemption, Boaz bought the field, and also Ruth, the Moabitess, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. Then there is that wonderful parable in Matthew 13, verse 45, of the merchant seeking goodly pearls. He bought the whole field, just as our Lord bought the whole earth. Many of the records of the Old Testament purchases occur before the prophet Jeremiah, who we would now like to consider. He was the last of the prophets in the land before it was overthrown by Babylon, and had much to say regarding Israel, Judah, and the land. The land was desolated under his watch and is restored according to his word of prophecy. His life and work overlapped that with Ezekiel and Daniel. It was an ominous and foreboding time in Israel's history, as they saw the decline in their own empire and spirit. It was a time when prophets were heard by the people, yet rejected by kings. There's probably no prophet with such a diverse life as Jeremiah. In the first few verses of Jeremiah, we learn that he was born at Anathoth, a small town situated 2 or 3 miles north of Jerusalem, but still in the territory of Benjamin. He belonged to a priestly family, probably the same who carried the Ark of the Covenant after return from Egypt. His father was Hilkiah, a priest of Anathoth, but it is generally thought that this is not the same Hilkiah, the high priest, that brought forth the book of the law from the cleansed temple in the days of Josiah in 2 Kings 22. Particularly, Jeremiah's father is not called a high priest of Jerusalem, yet he was a Levite of Anathoth. So, in a sense, Jeremiah came from a line of those who sounded a trumpet in the land. Nevertheless, Jeremiah began his ministry in the days of Josiah, Judah's last good king, and continued during the four successors until Zedekiah. He saw both reform and rebellion, repentance and defiance. Through it all, Jeremiah ceased not to declare the whole counsel of God, whether the people would hear or whether they would forbear. He was a very young man when he began his work in chapter 1, 4 through 7. It was just at this time that the plundering of Scythian hordes, which troubled Asia for decades in the second half of the 7th century, swept past the western boundary of Palestine on their swift horses to capture rich booties in the land of Egypt. Since he continued to prophesy until the conquest and destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, Jeremiah's prophetic career covered a period of more than 40 years. All the important events of this period are reflected in his prophecies. The religious reforms instituted by Josiah, the first deportation to Babylon, that of Jehoiachin or Jeconiah, and the final catastrophe of the Jewish kingdom. Jeremiah was opposed to the priesthood of the sanctuary at Jerusalem, just as his family had opposed them in former times. There were matters of both a corrupt priesthood and a corrupt throne, Jeremiah 1, 16 and 17. Jeremiah confronted those who compromised. It is Jeremiah who definitely predicted that Jerusalem would become a desolate heap and a den of dragons in chapter 9, verse 11, and chapter 26, verse 18. Yet while Jerusalem would become desolate, a place of hissing and a curse, this would last 70 years, according to Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12, after which Israel could return and inhabit the city again, Jeremiah 29, verse 10 and 14. For this reason, Jeremiah counseled the people to not resist the judgments of the Lord and to settle patiently in Babylon, to build houses there, plant gardens, and raise up another generation that will return. Jeremiah 29, verse 5 and 28. So Jeremiah denounced Judah's compromising priesthood, the evil kings, and the waywardness of the people. When King Jehoiakim heard the prophecies of his book, read by the court reader Jehudi, he cast the scroll into the palace fireplace, sheet by sheet, as it was read to him. It had taken over a year to write this manuscript, according to Jeremiah 36, verse 1 and verse 9. But not deterred, Jeremiah rewrote the book with the help of his faithful secretary, Baruch. It is not surprising that to silence him, he was detained in bonds, imprisoned in dungeons, let down into a miry pit of slime, yet not destroyed for fear of the people who still heard the message, and partly because the leaders somewhat feared his prophetic visions might be true. They didn't kill him, but they isolated him. With all the austere hardships in Jeremiah's life, the Lord gave him another directive. In Jeremiah 16, verse 2, "Thou shalt not take thee a wife, neither shalt thou have sons or daughters in this place." Verse 3. For thus saith the Lord concerning the sons and concerning the daughters that are born in this place, and concerning their mothers that bear them, and concerning their fathers that begat them in this land, they shall die of grievous deaths. So Jeremiah never married. He had no children. He had no heirs. At least he was spared the loss and agony that children of Jerusalem were soon to face themselves. Now, amidst this background, Jeremiah was not altogether a messenger of woe. He was commissioned in chapter 1, verse 10, to not only pull down and destroy, but also to build and to plant. Jeremiah 30, 10 and 11 prophesies a return from the land of their captivity and from all nations where they were scattered, to be in rest and be quiet, and none shall make them afraid. I think I'm getting a little out of sequence. We need to move ahead one more. That's Jeremiah 1:10, in chapter 30, 10 and 11. And now chapter 31, 31 and 34, give the details of the new covenant with Israel and Judah, wherein all shall know the Lord, from the least to the greatest. While Israel may have thought this to be the work accomplished under the delivering hand of Cyrus, yet in the fullest sense, it is a messianic promise for many generations ahead of their times at the hand of a greater than Cyrus. Against this background, we want to examine in some detail chapter 32. It begins in the 10th year of Zedekiah and the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. That was just 1 year before Jerusalem fell. Jeremiah 32, 1-3. Jeremiah was detained in this prison place in the palace, but probably not under chains, but high security, for he could even there have some visitors. But he was kept off the streets from further inciting the public. While in prison, he has the word of the Lord come to him in verses 6 and 7. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Behold, Hanameel, the son of Shallum, thine uncle, shall come upon unto thee, saying, Buy thee my field that is in Anathoth, for the right of redemption is thine to buy it. So Hanameel was his first cousin, and as such had the right of redemption. If Hanameel needed some quick cash in this desperate hour, in Babylon, as Babylon had already entered the land, then according to the Mosaic law, Jeremiah had the right to purchase it. The Levites had orchards or fields beyond the city walls, according to Numbers 35, 2 and 3. And these suburbs were community grazing fields, and therefore a perpetual inheritance that no one person could sell, according to Leviticus 25, 34. But there was a different rule for Levitical property that was inside the city. So this must have been some personal meadow or orchard or garden within the city of which the Levites could hold and exchange among themselves only. Leviticus 25, 32-33. According to Leviticus 25, 25, the next of kin could buy this, keeping it in the hands of the Levitical family. Such a bill of sale would be evidence not only for the Levite owner, but that this whole city belonged to the perpetual Levitical appointment of Joshua 21, 18 and 19. When Joshua divided the land, he apportioned certain cities and towns to belong to the Levites. In any case, the Lord instructed Jeremiah to make the purchase, if and when Hanamel should come to him in prison. Jeremiah did not send him a proposal for the purchase. He waited for Hanamel to come to him. And so we come to verse 8. When Hanamel arrived, Jeremiah saw it as the fulfillment of the prediction. But why would he cumber himself with this purchase while detained in bonds? One could say he simply was obeying the voice of the Lord, and that is true. Or perhaps he wanted to assist his financially distressed cousin. One would not have expected, one, that a prophet should concern himself so far in the business of this world. And besides, who wants to buy fields in a neighborhood of a besieged city? Secondly, that one who had neither wife nor children should buy land. We find in Jeremiah 16, verse 2, that he had no family of his own, yet he may purchase for his own use while he lives and leave it to some children or relatives when he dies. He had none. Yet he could make no use of it while sitting in Zedekiah's prison either. It was most strange that he should buy a piece of land when he himself knew that the whole land was now to be laid waste and fall into the hands of the Chaldeans. And what good would this do to him? The Lord knew very well that the last typical jubilee had already been kept and that there would not be another to be held in Israel. But it was the will of God that he should buy it. And he complied, though the money would seem to have been a lost cause. So Jeremiah obeyed the voice of the Lord against every practical objection. But brethren, the eyes of a prophet see not as man sees. Jeremiah saw this as an affirmation that God would bring back his people, whom he foreknew, to this land of promise. For this reason, Jeremiah performed a very exacting public transaction. As so often was Jeremiah's custom, he acted out the prophecy. So in chapter 32, verse 9, how was he able to carry out this transaction while he was in prison? The key may have been which Barak later mentioned in verses 12 and 13. This was Jeremiah's secretary or amanuensis, but he may have been more than that. He may have also been Jeremiah's banker, his notary, his power of attorney. The money is brought and weighed out first before Hanamel. The form of expression for the purchase in Hebrew is quite unique and notable. It says 7 shekels and 10 pieces of silver. We read it as 17. 7 shekels and 10 pieces of silver. Some Hebrew scholars have read it to mean 7 shekels were of gold and only the 10 were of silver, making the sale notably larger than would have been understood by 17 shekels of silver alone. But now he agreed and he showed the evidence of the money with his cousin. This was a remarkable transaction where we might think a handshake, an exchange of a money pouch, would have been sufficient between family members. The first thing we notice is that the money seems to be weighed a second time, this time before witnesses. At this time in Israel, money was not stamped or marked with individual coin values, but the rare metal ingots were weighed for the total to be agreed upon. Furthermore, here came witnesses more than Baruch in the employ of Jeremiah. Here were independent legal notaries who came to the courtyard of the prison to validate this transaction. In such legal transactions, there were two indentures, of which one was the purchase deed and was signed by the purchaser and the witnesses. It was then sealed and handed to the buyer. The open deed was an exact copy and was intended for common use. If its authenticity was called into question, the sealed copy could be produced before a judge and the seal opened. And if its contents agreed with those of the open deed, the decision would be in the buyer's favor. We have here all the circumstances of this legal act. First, the offer is made for purchase of this ground, of course, only until the Jubilee. And yet there was to be no further Jubilee until the antitype. Second, the price is agreed on and the payment weighed in the balances. A contract or deed of sale is drawn up to which both parties agreed. Witnesses are brought forward to see it signed and sealed, for the contract was both subscribed and sealed. A duplicate of the deed was drawn, which was not to be sealed, but to lie open for public inspection or some public place where it might be safe and reviewed. And then the original was sealed up and put into an earthen pitcher in order to be preserved from accidents. This was delivered to the purchaser into the hands of Baruch to be preserved for the use of Jeremiah, and witnesses were called to attest the delivery. And finally, the subscribed book of the purchase, perhaps a town ledger or register, where such purchases were entered. Baruch was a scribe by profession, and the deeds were delivered into his hands before witnesses to be preserved for a long time. Perhaps the law in this case required that the instrument should be thus lodged in Jeremiah's or Baruch's home or residence. But in the present case, both the deeds and the original and duplicate were put into an earthen pitcher because the city was about to be burnt. And if lodged as usual, they would be destroyed in the final conflagration of flame. And so we come to verses 13 and 14. This means both the sealed and open were preserved in clay jars. The earthen or clay vessel was more durable and decay resistant than a wooden box or even a metal container, subject to corrosion and to water. The sealed vessel was secured, quote, to continue many days. This suggests it was buried in the earth or in a rainproof cave, though it is not exactly said. This earthen vessel with the deeds in it were to be put underground or a small cave and probably in some part of the field that it was bought. Had these writings been laid up in a chest or box, they might have been stolen or destroyed. And had they been laid in the earth by themselves, they would have rotted and consumed. But being put into dry earthen vessel, they might be preserved from injury of the air and the moisture of the earth, and so might continue many days or even many years or centuries. We have seen how such documents survived in the caves of Qumran for centuries and millennium in unsealed clay vessels. This really had nothing to do with those until Jeremiah's possible release. Finally, he didn't expect amnesty at the hands of Zedekiah. He knew the city was doomed by the advancing armies of Nebuchadnezzar. Supposedly, families would return after 70 years in Babylon and retrieve the documents and reestablish the priestly family functions in Anathoth. This would seem to be the prospect from verse 15. But here rises another anomaly. The title deed had been transferred from the family of Hanamiel to Jeremiah. With a twist of providence, he was not even taken to Babylon to perhaps even negotiate another transfer to another surviving family. Furthermore, Jeremiah had no family of his own to perpetuate this inheritance. It was rightfully his by divine decree. But he died in Egypt before he could ever return and take possession. More importantly, there is no further biblical record of these documents ever being retrieved or used for restoring this inheritance. It would seem to have been a lost or forgotten scrap of history, or a lost cause for Jeremiah's deliberations. Was God's appointment a lost cause? Now having delivered the documents to the faithful hands of his secretary and aide, Baruch, Jeremiah's prayer is recorded in verses 16 to 26. And I'd like to read just a few verses, to read Jeremiah 32, 16 and 17. And now when I had delivered the evidence of the purchase unto Baruch the son of Neri, I prayed unto the Lord, saying, Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made heaven and the earth, and thy great power, and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. And then coming down to verse 21, and hast brought forth thy people Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and with wonders and with a strong hand and with a stretched out arm and a great terror. And 23. And they came in and possessed it, and they obeyed not thy voice, neither walked in thy law. They have done nothing of all that thou commandest them to do. Therefore thou hast caused all this evil to come upon them. And finally, verse 25, And thou hast said unto me, O Lord God, buy thee the field for money, and take witness, for the city is given into the hand of the Chaldeans. The Lord answers him in verse 27, Is there anything too hard for me? Then proceeds a recounting of the just judgments upon Israel and Judah. But beginning in verse 28 and onwards, can't see if I've got the right slide up there. Perhaps I do. Begins a remarkable promise of ultimate return and restoration that reaches far beyond the return under Cyrus, and reaches the very blessings of the millennial kingdom, verses 37 to 44. Fantastic verses. Behold, I will gather them out of all countries whither I have driven them in mine anger, and in my fury, and in great wrath, and I will bring them again to this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear me forever for the good of them and their children after them. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them to do them good, but I will put my fear in their hearts that they shall not depart from me. Yea, I will rejoice over them to do them good, and I will plant them in this land, assuredly, with my whole heart and with my whole soul. For thus saith the Lord, like as I have brought all this great evil upon this people, so will I bring upon them all the good that I have promised them, and the fields shall be bought in this land, whereof ye shall say, it is desolate, without man or beast. It is given into the hand of the Chaldeans. Men shall buy fields for money, and subscribe evidence, and seal them, and take witness in the land of Benjamin, and in the places about Jerusalem, and in the cities of Judah, and in the cities of the mountains, and in the cities of the valley, and the cities of the south, and I will cause their captivity to return, saith the Lord. Notice the divine footnote here, that man shall buy fields for money, and subscribe evidence, and seal them, and take witness in the land of Benjamin and the places about Jerusalem. This is directly built upon the act prescribed by God for Jeremiah, of which he could see no fulfillment in his lifetime, nor any descendant could claim, even 70 years afterward. We are reminded of Deacon Stephen's discourse about Abraham in Acts chapter 7, verse 5. And he gave him none inheritance, no, not so much as to set his foot on, yet he promised that he would give it to him for possession and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. And Paul's comment in Hebrews 11:13, these all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So, here only when Jeremiah is resurrected among the ancient prophets will the power of this symbolic act be realized. Or will it be something more than symbolic? Let us look at the current city of Anathoth, now called Anata, and the sheep fields round about. Notice something peculiar about this city, where this field is located. You will notice on a map of Israel that there is what is called the Green Line, just somewhat northeast of Jerusalem, that marks what faithful citizens of Israel call Judea and Samaria, but what politicians call the West Bank. Anathoth, now called Anata, lies just east of this line, in the territory that Yitzhak Rabin negotiated with the Oslo Accords into the hands of Palestinian autonomy. The Palestinians, who now hold such a close margin to Jerusalem, look with ambition upon the holy city itself as their next possession. For now it lies just beyond the Green Line fence, where someone has painted a rather symbolic replica from the Sistine ceiling. Only a resurrected Jeremiah and Baruch will know just where those documents were secured for many days. It will not surprise us if Jeremiah's land deed will yet be used to annul the claims of foreigners and strangers. Who knows if the early deaths of Rabin and Sharon have suspended the work of giving away the land until the rightful owner appears to lay claim to this God-given inheritance. Furthermore, it will not be on the singular testimony of one claiming to be Jeremiah. Baruch was present at the signing and the sealing. He may have been one of the co-signers. Now there is no longer an archaeological doubt about the existence of the real Baruch. He is not part of biblical myth or conspiracy. In 1982, excavation continued in the city of David. In a four-room house, a cache of 51 small clay buttons were discovered. Baked hard by fire, these buttons were in fact ancient clay seals inscribed with the names of their owners. The technical name for such seals is boule. And so the place is now called the Boule House. Seldom does archaeology reveal artifacts bearing the names of people mentioned in the Bible. But among these boule was found the boule of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan. He was the one who advised Jehoiakim not to burn the scroll of Jeremiah. And then the other notable Bible characters were found also on these seals. Then there was another cache of over 250 inscribed boules that surfaced earlier from the city of David. Found among the collection was a seal bearing the name Baruch, son of Neri, the scribe. This Baruch was none other than the confidant and personal scribe of the prophet Jeremiah himself. He was a strategic part of the drama during the last days of the first temple and was once hidden by the Lord with Jeremiah when King Jehoiakim sought to arrest him. But an even more exciting revelation concerning this scribe was yet to come. Recently, it was revealed that another boule with the same name Baruch existed in a private collection. This seal, however, has an incredible difference. Preserved in the now hardened clay is the imprint of a finger. Since this boule belonged to Baruch, he is the one who would have last touched it. When sealing the papyrus scroll is secured. Therefore, this is most likely the actual fingerprint of Baruch himself, the secretary to Jeremiah. Who knows what might have been written on the scroll sealed by this boule? Could it have been a copy of the sealed deed, a purchase mentioned in Jeremiah 32, verse 14? Or perhaps a copy of Jeremiah's prophecies that conclude that chapter, verse 37 and 40? But there's nothing so very unique as a man's fingerprint. And I just learned this week. You know that even identical twins have uniquely different fingerprints. If Jeremiah should be resurrected, as a tree falleth, there will it lie. He produces his fingerprint, and it's a match to the seal. There will be no doubt he is one of the prophets. Behold, I will gather them out of all countries, whither I have driven them. In mine anger, I will bring them again unto this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God, and I will make an everlasting covenant with them. Truth is stranger than fiction. We now have the notary seal of the scribe. Soon Jeremiah himself may produce the evidence appointed by God that sealed the purchase in the rightful Levitical city of Joshua's division and Abraham's inheritance. And all false proclaimers we put to silence. This is not to be settled in the courts and congresses, in accords or treaties of the world, but it will be in the words of Zechariah 4, verse 6. This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, not by power, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. May the Lord add his blessing.